Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hey, Mona Shaw, I've got a little bit of a surprise for you.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing, Mark?
Oh, I think it's a good thing. It's certainly an interesting thing. I was going through our audience statistics, and it turns out that over 20% of our audience last month has been listening from India. And I know we've gone over 20% in China in the past, you know, months or maybe a year ago, but to see India surge up so much lately, I just thought it was really interesting. So that's my surprise for you. We have a huge Indian audience, or at least listening from India.
Actually, it's much bigger than that, Mark, because of the way the statistics, the way you have see them and the way we see them are a little different because it gets posted out. But we know there's a lot of local people who are Indian who have been listening. Just in the same way, there has been this surge of interest among Southeast Asians in EB5. And that's one of the reasons that we have chosen today's topic for today's podcast.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, Mona. You know, I see the statistics from the countries that people are listening at, but not from where they're from. So there could be a lot of Indian nationals here in the United States, which account for the other 60-some% of the audience downloads that we're getting for the show. So that's really interesting. But it sounds like you're kind of hinting at to me that there may be special considerations for Indian nationals that are here in the U.S. considering EB5.
No, not Indian nationals per se, but there are a lot of Indian nationals who are here in the United States on visas such as H-1Bs, L-1s, or even F-1s. So when you are here in the United States and you're filing for EB-5, there are different rules.
Hey, you're right, Mona. And that's why we're bringing back to the show a repeat guest, Clem Turner.
Clem has been on our podcast before, Mark, with all of his years, I mean, what, 23 years of experience and his practical knowledge in this area, especially within EB5, he seems like the perfect person to answer all of our questions.
That's right. Yeah, he was on 25 months ago when we were talking about either starting, buying, or renting a regional center. I mean, he knows
SEC. Seems a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. You know, he knows the Securities and Exchange Commission and their compliance, so he makes him the perfect guest to talk about today's topic.
Well, thanks for that vote of confidence. I will do my best.
Clem, I'm going to jump straight into it. You just heard me. Everybody is wondering why we are making a fuss about Form D filings right now. But each and every project and regional center seems to have had a huge influx of local filings, local investors. Local investors meaning people who have been here for 5, 10, 15 years on an H-1B or other visa.
Mm-hmm. And that could certainly account for it. So let's take a step back quickly. Let's rewind the tape a little bit and let me get into what a Form D actually is.
That would be great.
When you do a typical EB-5 offering, a lot of people out there use Regulation S, which is your offshore exemption. And all that you need to prove is that the investor is not a U.S. person. The deals were signed outside the United States. You know, there's no plan or scheme to have the shares trickle back into the United States exchange markets. And that exemption works just fine for the majority of EB-5 deals. Regulation D is the exemption used when you're selling in a private offering in the United States, and Regulation S may not be available to you. So if you are getting investors that are here on an H-1B, they won't qualify for Reg S. And so you'll be confronted with the question of whether or not to file a Form D, which is essentially a notice filing to the SEC.
Wow, that's a very clear explanation, Clem. Thank you for that. But tell me something. Do you need a Form D filing, securities filing in every kind of offering? Or say somebody just every kind of EB-5 offering, say somebody does their own EB-5 project and puts up their own hotel or their own maybe Dunkin' Donuts or something. Do they need to do a Form D filing?
The Form D is the official end of the Regulation D exemption process. So everyone is familiar with the requirements of Regulation D, or at least I hope they are. if you're using the old school Regulation D that was enacted back in the 70s, you cannot do any general solicitation and every investor has to be accredited. Step three would be filing a Form D at the end of that process. About 5 years ago, we passed the Jobs Act. Now you can do a general solicitation. You just have to confirm by a third party the accredited status. And again, Form D is the official last step of that process. And Form D is required from the point of view of compliance. However, there's no penalty for not filing a Form D. And to date, there hasn't really been a consequence for not filing a Form D.
I will butt in here because it may not be a consequence for what you've seen. We have started to see some major RFEs come in, especially on the establishment of regional centers, as to whether or not people have the capacity or have filed Form Ds. So I think it has come to the forefront, and I believe that within the next year or so, we are going to see at the SEC pick up on it.
Right, right.
As if USCIS are picking up on it, then the SEC will pick up on it.
Yes, it's extremely interesting that the push for compliance with respect to Form D filing is coming from USCIS and not the SEC. You know, obviously the SEC wants it, but the SEC hasn't been particularly concerned if it wasn't done. And I've been in scenarios where it's been filed late and what have you. So it's an extremely touchy issue.
Well, actually, there has been some regional centers who have lawsuits relating to this area as well.
Right. Well, there has been a very, very reputable regional center out there that was recently...
Not mentioning names, you don't want to mention names, yeah.
Right, right. That recently entered into a settlement action. They had a lot more issues to grapple with than just the Form D.
But Form D was still part of it.
Of course, obviously, if there's one issue, then there's 10. The SEC is certainly not going to be shy about piling on.
Yeah.
To date, I have not had a regional center client that's been specifically contacted by the SEC with respect to this Form D question.
But if it does happen, are there penalties? Because we are actually really pushing a lot of our project clients, our regional center clients, to file Form D.
Yeah, no, that's a good idea. And penalties may be coming. You know, to date, no, there aren't penalties. Your offering is technically not in compliance without filing the Form D, but the SEC has never brought that enforcement action.
Okay, if your offering is, you know what's happening right now. People are looking for ways to get out of their offering, mm-hmm. whether it's because of visa retrogression, like the Chinese are trying to do, or other reasons. So if a project has not filed a Form D, if you're saying it's not in compliance, is that a reason for rescission and return of your money?
It gives a plaintiff's attorney something to argue, certainly, though to date, there's never been a rescission that's been ordered that was based on a lack of a Form D.
Okay. So you didn't answer my question. If there's no PPM, if it's your own project, do you still need to file Form D?
Yes. And a lot of people get confused about what a PPM is and how that relates to securities laws, and what a Form D is and how that relates to securities laws. The Form D requirement is based on the way that you sell the offering, either through offshore mechanics, and then you have to follow the Regulation S exemption, or through the private equity mechanics, and then you have to follow the Regulation D exemption. But neither of those things have to do with disclosure.
Right.
That's a totally separate area of securities laws that's embedded in the anti-fraud obligations that investors, that issuers have, and an obligation to give all material information to investors so they can make an investment decision. So that's a matter of content, whether you have a PPM or not. Your exemptions are a matter of process. So whether or not you have a PPM, which you may opt not to if you have a small enough offering, and you've employed other means of getting disclosure out there, like a matter of business plan, and you know, maybe you've had separate risk factors, and maybe you've cobbled together something for a very small offering where a PPM might not be cost effective. However, you still have to maintain the mechanics and the process of Form D. And let me also say, if you have cobbled together an offering without a PPM, you're in greater danger of being non-compliant on the anti-fraud obligation.
We do have, unfortunately, clients who did not want to file a PPM, but they try to overcome any sort of requirements by putting everybody in a managerial capacity.
Oh, okay. You know, arguable whether that would work or not. The SEC really does not tend to put form over substance. If substantively you should have had a PPM, they tend to look through the form that you've utilized. The analysis of whether you've met your 10b-5 obligation is really a factual one. If you have a PPM, it's very easy to prove that you've met the factual disclosure requirements. If you don't, you have more hoops to jump through, and you may be found to have not met it, in which case you have a big issue. So you definitely take your chances if you don't deliver a PPM in any offering that you do.
Okay.
But let's not get off. That's a whole nother podcast.
But he's asking to be back, Mark, for third time.
Yes, we can definitely come back and talk about...
In another 25 months, right?
Right. Or hopefully sooner.
But is the form defiled on a federal level or a state level, or both?
So let me describe what information is given in a Form D. It isn't a very long or detailed form. It essentially asks for information about the issuer, information about the owners of the issuer. So still, there's a lot of disclosure about who is doing this offering and who owns them. And then there's information on the states in which the offering has been, states in which the offering has been made. So investors in various states that have been targeted for this offering, you have to disclose which states you've actively sought investors from. Then there's broker-dealer information that's requested. And aside from the names and contact information for those broker-dealers, as well as their FINRA number, it asks for the consideration paid to those broker-dealers. So if you're doing a traditional EB-5 offering where you're in Reg S and you've used foreign agents, none of whom are broker-dealers, none of whom have a FINRA number, and certainly that information as to who is sourcing investors in your offering could be proprietary, trade secret. You know, it could be definitely something that a regional center does not want to be out there in the public, as well as the consideration paid. You can see why when we originally looked at this issue 5-10 years ago, why we would opt to not file the Form D.
Yeah.
Because you were primarily relying on Reg S anyway. But you had all this other...
You can also see why USCIS are RFEing in regional center petitions, et cetera, mm-hmm. as to whether people are compliant with Form D filings.
Yes, exactly. Mm. But that's the information requested. To follow up on your question now with respect to is it a state form or a federal form, it's a federal form. However, any state that you indicate that you are seeking investors in, and once you obtain an investor from that state, those states' laws require you to give them notice, which typically involves sending them an updated Form D, as well as paying some fee to access the citizens of that particular state.
Okay. Well, I have two questions. I have a scenario and I have a question. And mm-hmm. these, I have to tell you, are all questions which our listeners and clients have emailed to us and requested, and the type of questions we're constantly being asked. First of all, scenario. Client number one picks up a project and sees that he is able to bring, for the amount of the project, he's able to bring a few of his friends into the same EB-5 project. So he himself invests, and then he brings in two or three friends who are also investing. Mm-hmm. They don't have a PPM because they're all three friends together, and they're investing in this project. Do they have to file a Form D?
Is the person who's initially raising the capital, are they going into their own project or someone else's project?
No, it's their own project. It's his project, and then they've decided that they want to bring in two or three friends. This is a very common scenario that we are seeing, especially from within the Indian community.
Right, I see. And that's a situation where an 80 to 120-page PPM may not necessarily be appropriate, although it would be required for compliance. You know, those are instances where securities lawyers and clients talk about what makes sense. Having said that, in that scenario, there are a variety of ways that you can document the securities offering that has taken place with the one person who is investing for EB-5 but investing in their own project. The other two friends, if you classify that offering as a Regulation D exempted transaction, then you would have to file a Form D. However, you could classify that as an old-fashioned private placement, which is Rule 4.2. Under the securities laws, you're not within the safety of Regulation D if something goes wrong. If you follow all of the rules of Regulation D, you're comfortable that you've done a bona fide private offering.
So if something goes wrong in future and the friends fall out and one friend tries to sue the other, could they use the fact that it was an offering and it wasn't properly put together because there was no Form D to just get out of the whole transaction?
It's possible, although it's unlikely the Form D would be the crux of their argument, but it would be something that they would bring up.
Right.
If the issuer is going to rely on 4.2, which was the old-fashioned private placement rule before Regulation D was enacted, the person suing for rescission to get their money back would have to show that a general solicitation took place, which would probably be difficult in this in the fact pattern that you've laid out.
Right.
I guess it would ultimately depend on how many people went into that offering and what their relationships were. The more tangential the investors are to the principal, the harder it would be to defend an old-fashioned 4.2 private placement where you don't have the safety of following a Regulation D exemption.
Very interesting, Clem. Thank you. But this is going to lead on to my next question.
Sure.
Which is something that I know people are being very confused about. There's a lot of local seminars going on around the country, again, targeting H-1B and L-1 mm-hmm. applicants. And they talk about being an accredited investor, and I don't feel as though they're giving the correct information. I have to give you a little scenario. Somebody wrote to us and asked that they were very confused and did not understand what an incredible investor was.
That's fantastic.
An investor that wears a cape.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that for Form D filings and for, you know, just generally accredited investor filings within the United States, you had to be verified through a third party. Now, is this always the case? A third party being like a CPA?
That is for instances where you have done a general solicitation. So if you are using the new rules under Reg D, which were promulgated under Barack Obama's Jobs Act, you are essentially crowd financing. And the new Regulation D rules require a third party, like an accountant, like a lawyer, or a financial planner, to verify that the investor meets the net worth requirements of an accredited investor. If you are doing the original Reg D, which was passed back in the 70s, I believe, and wasn't adjusted until just recently with the Jobs Act, if you're using the old original Regulation D exemption, you are allowed as an issuer to rely on a questionnaire that you give the investor where he checks a box mm-hmm. indicating that he meets this threshold.
Which most regional centers and most projects do, actually.
Yes.
Very few projects ask or request a third-party verification.
Yes. Most EB-5 is done with the old rules.
Right.
There are some people out there who are taking advantage of crowd financing in the EB-5 space. However, regardless of which way you go, you do ultimately, if you're using Regulation D, old or new, a Form D is required. And the SEC specifically asks on its new amended Form D whether you have conducted a general solicitation or not. And if you have, it is much more advisable to file that Form D to alert the SEC that you've done this. The thinking is by doing a general solicitation, you're opening up the issuer to a little bit more liability, and you want to come clean to the SEC about who it is you're using.
Clem, I realize we can carry on talking about this area for at least another podcast, because you talk about areas, specific areas like New York, which is kind of complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But we really wanted to ask you questions relating to the another hot topic, which is coming up. And we are getting questions from both developers as well as investors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on oversubscription.
Mm-hmm.
Just briefly for our listeners, what is oversubscription and why are we seeing a rise in project oversubscription? Well, oversubscription would be classed as if you have a project which had originally 30 people or 50 investors and now it's full and suddenly the project developers are going back and raising more capital. We have to take care of that. You can't just raise the capital and just let it go.
Right.
So first of all, Clem, why are we seeing a rise in project oversubscription?
Well, I'd welcome your opinion on this as well, but my personal opinion is issuers are concerned if one of the investors or some number of their investors get denied.
Or even try to pull out.
Mm-hmm, or try to pull out. So they're in the market, they have momentum, they've spent a lot of time and money and effort and resources, frankly, getting a project out there and momentum in whatever country they're focused on. They don't necessarily want to shut that marketing machine down. And then if they lose an investor through withdrawal or lose an investor through a denial, gear that machine up again. It's a lot simpler to take another couple of investors and see what happens.
I agree. I think that is one of the reasons. But also what we have seen is that people who are investing now, a lot of people want to go into a project where there's been an approval.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't normally find a project because of the time that it's taking. I mean, about 2 years, it's very rare that that project would still have spots open. So mm-hmm. usually that project's all completed and now they have the approval and people feel comfortable going into that. So I feel like that's what a lot of developers are seeing, that they can bring in another 2 or 3 or 4 million. So mm-hmm. if they have the job cushion, Then
they go ahead and do it.
They go ahead and do it.
Right. And that's definitely the other side of the coin. You know, as you know, with me, I deal primarily with the developers and regional centers on the developer side. And you're dealing more with the investors. And I think both of those rationales combined to lead to more oversubscriptions.
But oversubscription has a couple of very serious concerns, both with the USCIS side as well as the SEC side.
Yes. And I can definitely attempt to speak to both.
Yeah, go ahead.
The first relates to valuation, which in EB-5 context is much less important. In a typical offering, the number of interests that you're selling at a particular price lead to the total amount of the offering. And there's some logic that has gone into figuring out what the appropriate price is.
Usually relating to jobs.
Oh, no, I mean in the non-EB-5 world.
Oh, I see.
Right, in the non-EB-5 world. So in the non-EB-5 world, if you sell more shares than you had planned and raise additional money, you are diluting people who came into that offering thinking that if I write a check for X amount, I'm going to get X percentage. And I want at least X percentage of this company to make it a worthwhile investment to me. And if an oversubscription happens, I've written the check for the same amount, but I wind up with less control of the company or I wind up with less ownership percentage of the company. And I may be okay with that, but I may not. So, you know, the issuer should come back and let me know. And typically what happens is an oversubscription is built into the offering up front. You know, we're going out for 10 million, but we may oversubscribe and take 11. You know, we may oversubscribe and make 12 if conditions are met. And if the circumstances allow. In the EB-5 context, there isn't really the same concern about dilution. The investors are all typically getting some form of preferred equity into the EB-5 issuer. They don't really have a lot of voting rights. They're not really all that concerned about their pro rata percentage. They're primarily going to get a preferred return, no matter if they're the only investor or there are 50 other investors. So from an economic perspective, from a control perspective, an oversubscription doesn't really matter. However, in the EB-5 context, what does matter a lot is the job cushion.
Of course. In fact, that could be the deciding factor for many people for which project they choose.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely a symbol of safety to have a larger cushion.
Yeah.
And, you know, if your cushion starts out at 25%, putting you over kind of the market's 20% threshold, you know, the unofficial market knowledge in the EB-5 space that a 20% job cushion is relatively safe. So if you go from a 25% job cushion and you oversubscribe and you fall to an 18 or 15% job cushion, you know, that's something that could be pretty material to an investor. If that's something that you would like to do, we would certainly advise strongly for a client to send out a notice and attempt to get consent from the investors that they already have if they are going to significantly reduce the job cushion in an oversubscription scenario.
Right. We make sure that people do that with our interfilings.
Mm-hmm.
One very important point. When do we file Form Ds?
I'm glad you asked, Mona. The initial Form D filing needs to be filed within 15 days of the first sale, which, as you know, is right at the onset of your offering. And you may not know all the states you're going to be in. And certainly, you don't have a full picture of the entire offering within 15 days, not an EB-5. What is typical is for the Form D to be filed within 15 days of the first sale, and then another Form D to be filed at the end of the offering, which amends the initial Form D and provides all of that information to the SEC. If your offering takes longer than a year, what some people do is file annual updates of their Form D to get that information to the SEC in a timely manner. While there isn't any set rule about when these updates have to take place, typically doing it at least annually is a very good idea. And obviously doing it at the end when you can identify all the states that might necessarily have a claim to be notified, doing it at the end so those states do get their notice filings and whatever registration fees they require.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, Clem Turner, thank you so much for coming back on EB-5 Investment Voice.
My pleasure.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.